"Troubles aren't over, I'm afraid," the colonel said, referring to the mailed but not yet received progress reports.
"All right, if you say so. We'll talk when it's over, I guess."
"I guess so," the colonel said. As Kevin walked out, the colonel said, "Take the can you spit in, you unhygienic shit." Kevin just closed the door behind him. The colonel grabbed the can, opened the door, and threw it at Kevin, missing him by a good margin.
"Geez, go easy on the guy."
"No truce yet, Pudge."
I spent that afternoon with Lara. We were very cutesy, even though we didn't know the first thing about each other and barely talked. But we made out. She grabbed my butt at one point, and I sort of jumped. I was lying down, but I did the best version of jumping that one can do lying down. And she said, "Sorry." And I said, "No, it's okay, it's just a little sore from the swan." We walked to the TV room together, and I locked the door. We were watching The Brady Bunch, which she had never seen. The episode, where the Bradys visit the gold mining ghost town and they all get locked up in a one-room jail by some crazy old gold panner with a scraggly white beard, was especially horrible and gave us a lot to laugh about. Which is good, since we didn't have much to talk about. Just as the Bradys were getting locked in jail, Lara randomly asked me, "Have you ever gotten a blowjob?"
"That's out of the blue," I said.
"The blue?
Like, you know, out of left field."
"Left field?
Like in baseball, like out of nowhere. I mean, what made you think of that?"
"I've just never given one," she answered, her little voice dripping with seductiveness. "It was so brazen. I thought I would explode. I never thought. I mean, from Alaska, hearing that stuff was one thing. But to hear her sweet little Romanian voice go so sexy all of a sudden."
"No," I said, "I never have."
"Think it would be fun?"
"Do I?" I thought.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to." "I think I want to," she said, and we kissed a little. And then,
with me sitting watching the Brady Bunch, watching Marsha, Marsha, Marsha up to her Brady antics, Laura unbuttoned my pants and pulled my boxers down a little and pulled out my penis.
"Wow," she said.
"What?" She looked up at me but didn't move, her face nanometers away from my penis.
"It's weird."
"What do you mean, weird?"
"Just big, I guess."
I could live with that kind of weird. And then she wrapped her hand around it and put it into her mouth and waited. We were both very still. She did not move a muscle in her body, and I did not move a muscle in mine. I knew at this point something else was supposed to happen, but I wasn't quite sure what. She stayed still. I could feel her nervous breath. For minutes, for as long as it took the Bradys to steal the key and unlock themselves from the ghost town jail, she lay there, stock still, with my penis in her mouth, and I sat there, waiting. And then she took it out of her mouth and looked up at me quizzically.
"Should I do something?"
"I don't know," I said. Everything I'd learned from watching porn with Alaska suddenly exited my brain. I thought maybe she should move her head up and down, but wouldn't that choke her? So I just stayed quiet.
"Should I, like, bite?"
"Don't bite! I mean, I don't think. That felt good, that was nice. I don't know if there's something else."
"I mean, you didn't...
Maybe we should ask Alaska." So we went to her room and asked Alaska. She laughed and laughed. Sitting on her bed, she laughed until she cried. She walked into the bathroom, returned with a tube of toothpaste, and showed us. In detail. Never have I so wanted to be crest complete. Lara and I went back to her room, where she did exactly what Alaska told her to do, and I did exactly what Alaska said I would do, which was die 100 little ecstatic deaths, my fists clenched, my body shaking. It was my first orgasm with a girl, and afterward I was embarrassed and nervous, and so clearly was Lara, who finally broke the silence by asking,
"So, do you want to do some homework?"
There was little to do on the first day of the semester, but she read for her English class. I picked up a biography of Argentinian revolutionary Che Guevara, whose face adorned a poster on the wall that Lara's roommate had on her bookshelf. Then I lay down next to Lara on the bottom bunk.
I began at the end, as I sometimes did with biographies I had no intention of reading all the way through, and found his last words without too much searching. Captured by the Bolivian army, Guevara said, "Shoot, coward. You are only going to kill a man." I thought back to Simón Bolívar's last words in García Márquez's novel, "How Will I Ever Get Out of This Labyrinth?" South American revolutionaries, it would seem, died with flair. I read the last words out loud to Lara. She turned on her side, placing her head on my chest.
"Why do you like last words so much?"
Strange as it might seem, I'd never really thought about why.
"I don't know,"
I said, placing my hand against the small of her back. "Sometimes, just because they're funny. Like, in the Civil War, a general named Sedgwick said, 'They couldn't hit an elephant from this dis-,' and then he got shot."
She laughed.
"But a lot of times, people die how they live, and so last words tell me a lot about who people were and why they became the sort of people biographies get written about. Does that make sense?"
"Yeah,"
she said.
"Yeah?
Just yeah?"
"Yeah,"
she said, and then went back to reading.
I didn't know how to talk to her,
and I was frustrated with trying, so after a little while, I got up to go. I kissed her goodbye. I could do that, at least. I picked up Alaska and the colonel at our room, and we walked down to the bridge, where I repeated in embarrassing detail the fellatio fiasco.
"I can't believe she went down on you twice in one day," the colonel said.
"Only technically, really just once," Alaska corrected.
Still, Pudge got his hog smoked."
"The poor colonel," Alaska said with a rueful smile. "I'd give you a pity blow, but I really am attached to Jake."
"That's just creepy," the colonel said. "You're only supposed to flirt with Pudge."
"But Pudge has a girlfriend," she laughed.
That night, the colonel and I walked down to Alaska's room to celebrate our barn night success. She and the colonel had been celebrating a lot the past couple days, and I didn't feel up to climbing Strawberry Hill, so I sat and munched on pretzels while Alaska and the colonel drank wine from paper cups with flowers on them.
"We ain't drinking out the bottle tonight, hon," the colonel said. "We classin' it up."
"It's an old-time southern drinking contest," Alaska responded. "We's a-gonna treat Pudge to an evening of real southern livin'. We gon' match each other Dixie cup for Dixie cup till the lesser drinker falls."
And that is pretty much what they did, pausing only to turn out the lights at 11 so the eagle wouldn't drop by. They chatted some, but mostly they drank, and I drifted out of the conversation and ended up squinting through the dark, looking at the book spines in Alaska's life library. Even minus the books she'd lost in the mini-flood, I could have stayed up until morning reading through haphazard stacks of titles. A dozen white tulips in a plastic vase were precariously perched atop one of the book stacks, and when I asked her about them, she just said, "Jake and Mai's anniversary," and I didn't care to continue that line of dialogue, so I went back to scanning titles. And I was just wondering how I could go about learning Edgar Allan Poe's last words, for the record, "Lord help my poor soul," when I heard Alaska say,
"Pudge isn't even listening to us."
And I said, "I'm listening.
We were just talking about truth or dare. Played out in seventh grade or still cool?"
"Never played it," I said. "No friends in seventh grade."
"Well, that does it,"
she shouted, a bit too loud given the late hour, and also given the fact that she was openly drinking wine in the room.
"Truth or dare?"
"All right," I agreed, "but I'm not making out with the colonel." The colonel sat slumped in the corner.
"Can't make out. Too drunk."
Alaska started.
"Truth or dare, Pudge?"
"Dare."
"Hook up with me."
So I did. It was that quick. I laughed, looked nervous, and she leaned in and tilted her head to the side, and we were kissing. Zero layers between us. Our tongues dancing back and forth in each other's mouth until there was no her mouth and my mouth, but only our mouths intertwined. She tasted like cigarettes and Mountain Dew and wine and chapstick. Her hand came to my face, and I felt her soft fingers tracing the line of my jaw. We lay down as we kissed, she on top of me, and I began to move beneath her. I pulled away for a moment to say, "What is going on here?" And she put one finger to her lips, and we kissed again. A hand grabbed one of mine, and she placed it on her stomach. I moved slowly on top of her and felt her arching her back fluidly beneath me. I pulled away again. "What about Lara? Jake?" Again, she shushed me. "Less tongue, more lips," she said, and I tried my best. I thought the tongue was the whole point, but she was the expert.
"Christ," the colonel said quite loudly, "that wretched beast drama draws nigh."
But we paid no attention. She moved my hand from her waist to her breast, and I felt cautiously, my fingers moving slowly under her shirt but over her bra, tracing the outline of her breasts and then cupping one in my hand, squeezing softly.
"You're good at that," she whispered.
Her lips never left mine as she spoke. We moved together, my body between her legs.
"This is so fun," she whispered, "but I'm so sleepy. To be continued?"
She kissed me for another moment, my mouth straining to stay near hers, and then she moved from beneath me, placed her head on my chest, and fell asleep instantly. We didn't have sex. We never got naked. I never touched her bare breast, and her hands never got lower than my hips. It didn't matter. As she slept, I whispered, "I love you, Alaska Young." Just as I was falling asleep, the colonel spoke.
"Dude, did you just make out with Alaska?"
"Yeah."
"This is going to end poorly," he said to himself.
And then I was asleep. That deep, can still taste her in my mouth sleep. That sleep that's not particularly restful, but is difficult to wake from all the same. And then I heard the phone ring. I think. And I think, although I can't know, that I felt Alaska get up. I think I heard her leave. I think. How long she was gone is impossible to know. But the colonel and I both woke up when she returned, whenever that was, because she slammed the door. She was sobbing, like that post-Thanksgiving morning, but worse.
"I have to get out of here," she cried.
"What's wrong?" I asked.
"I forgot. God, how many times can I fuck up?" she said.
I didn't even have time to wonder what she forgot before she screamed,
"I just have to go. Help me get out of here."
"Where do you need to go?" She sat down and put her head between her legs, sobbing.
"Just please distract the eagle right now so I can go, please."
The colonel and I, at the same moment, equal in our guilt, said, "Okay."
"Just don't turn on your lights," the colonel said. "Just drive slow and don't turn on your lights. Are you sure you're okay?" "Fuck," she said. "Just get rid of the eagle for me," she said,
her sobs childlike half-screams.
"God, oh God, I'm so sorry."
"Okay," colonel said. "Start the car when you hear the second string." We left. We did not say, "Don't drive. You're drunk." We did not say, "We aren't letting you in that car when you are upset." We did not say, "We insist on going with you." We did not say, "This can wait until tomorrow. Anything, everything can wait." We walked to our bathroom, grabbed the three strings of leftover firecrackers from beneath the sink, and ran to the Eagles. We weren't sure that it would work again. But it worked well enough. The eagle tore out of his house as soon as the first string of firecrackers started popping. He was waiting for us, I suppose, and we headed for the woods and got him in deeply enough that he never heard her drive away. The colonel and I doubled back, wading through the creek to save time, slipped in through the back window of room 43, and slept like babies. After. The day after. The colonel slept the not-restful sleep of the drunk, and I lay on my back on the bottom bunk, my mouth tingling and alive, as if still kissing, and we would have likely slept through our morning classes had the eagle not awoken us at 8 o'clock with three quick knocks. I rolled over as he opened the door, and the morning light rushed into the room.
"I need y'all to go to the gym," he said.
I squinted toward him, the eagle himself backlit into invisibility by the too bright sun.
"Now," he added, and I knew it, "we were done for, caught.
Too many progress reports. Too much drinking in too short a time. Why did they have to drink last night?" And then I could taste her again, the wine and the cigarette smoke and the chapstick and Alaska. And I wondered if she had kissed me because she was drunk. "Don't expel me," I thought. "Don't. I have just begun to kiss her." And as if answering my prayers, the eagle said, "You're not in any trouble, but you need to go to the gym now."
I heard the colonel rolling over above me. "What's wrong?"
"Something terrible has happened," the eagle said, and then closed the door. As he grabbed a pair of jeans lying on the floor, the colonel said,
"This happened a couple years ago, when Hyde's wife died. I guess it's the old man himself now. Poor bastard really didn't have many breaths left."
He looked up at me, his half-open eyes bloodshot, and yawned.
"You look a little hungover," I observed.
He closed his eyes.
"Well, then I'm putting up a good front, Pudge, 'cause I'm actually a lot hungover."
I kissed Alaska.
"Yeah, I wasn't that drunk. Let's go."
We walked across the dorm circle to the gym. I sported baggy jeans, a sweatshirt with no shirt underneath, and a bad case of bedhead. All the teachers were in the dorm circle, knocking on doors, but I didn't see Dr. Hyde. I imagined him lying dead in his house, wondering who had found him, how they even knew he was missing before he failed to show up for class.
"I don't see Dr. Hyde," I told the colonel. "Poor bastard."
The gym was half full by the time we arrived. A podium had been set up in the middle of the basketball court, close to the bleachers. I sat in the second row with the colonel directly in front of me. My thoughts were split between sadness for Dr. Hyde and excitement about Alaska, remembering the up-close sight of her mouth whispering, "To be continued?" And it did not occur to me, not even when Dr. Hyde shuffled into the gym, taking tiny, slow steps toward the colonel and me. I tapped the colonel on the shoulder and said, "Hyde's here." And the colonel said, "Oh, shit." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Where's Alaska?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Pudge, is she here or not?" And then we both stood up and scanned the faces in the gym. The eagle walked to the podium and said, "Is everyone here?" "No," I said to him, "Alaska isn't here." The eagle looked down. "Is everyone else here?" "Alaska isn't here." "Okay, Miles, thank you."
"We can't start without Alaska."
The eagle looked at me. He was crying, noiselessly. Tears just rolled from his eyes to his chin and then fell onto his corduroy pants. He stared at me, but it was not the look of doom. His eyes blinking the tears down his face, the eagle looked for all the world sorry.
"Please, sir," I said, "can we please wait for Alaska?"
I felt all of them staring at us, trying to understand what I now knew but didn't quite believe. The eagle looked down and bit his lower lip.
"Last night, Alaska Young was in a terrible accident."
His tears came faster then.
"And she was killed. Alaska has passed away."
For a moment, everyone in the gym was silent, and the place had never been so quiet, not even in the moments before the colonel ridiculed opponents at the free throw stripe. I stared down at the back of the colonel's head. I just stared, looking at his thick and bushy hair. For a moment, it was so quiet that you could hear the sound of not breathing, the vacuum created by 190 students shocked out of air. I thought, it's all my fault. I thought, I don't feel very good. I thought, I'm going to throw up. I stood up and ran outside. I made it to a trash can outside the gym, 5 feet from the double doors, and heaved toward Gatorade bottles and half-eaten McDonald's. But nothing much came out. I just heaved, my stomach muscles tightening and my throat opening and a gasping guttural blech going through the motions of vomiting over and over again. In between gags and coughs, I sucked air in hard. Her mouth. Her dead, cold mouth. To not be continued. I knew she was drunk, upset. Obviously, you don't let someone drive drunk and pissed off. Obviously. And Christ, Miles, what the hell is wrong with you? And then comes the puke, finally splashing onto the trash. And here is whatever of her I had left in my mouth, here in this trash can. And then it comes again, more. And then, okay, calm down. Okay, seriously, she's not dead. She's not dead. She's alive. She's alive somewhere. She's in the woods. Alaska is hiding in the woods, and she's not dead. She's just hiding. She's playing a trick on us. This is just an Alaska Young prank extraordinaire. It's Alaska being Alaska, funny and playful and not knowing when or how to put on the brakes. And then I felt much better, because she had not died at all. I walked back into the gym, and everyone seemed to be in various stages of disintegration. It was like something you see on TV, like a National Geographic special on funeral rituals. I saw Takumi standing over Lara, his hands on her shoulders. I saw Kevin with his crew cut, his head buried between his knees. A girl named Molly Tan, who'd studied with us for pre-calc, wailed, beating bald fists against her thighs. All these people I sort of knew and sort of didn't, and all of them disintegrating. And then I saw the colonel, his knees tucked into his chest, lying on his side on the bleachers, Madame O'Malley sitting next to him, reaching toward his shoulder but not actually touching it. The colonel was screaming. He would inhale and then scream. Inhale. Scream. Inhale. Scream. I thought at first that it was only yelling, but after a few breaths I noticed a rhythm, and after a few more I realized that the colonel was saying words. He was screaming, "I'm so sorry." Madame O'Malley grabbed his hand. "You've got nothing to be sorry for, Chip. There was nothing you could have done." But if only she knew. And I just stood there, looking at the scene, thinking about her not dead, and I felt a hand on my shoulder and turned around to see the eagle. And I said, "I think she's playing a dumb prank." And he said, "No, Miles, no. I'm sorry." And I felt the heat in my cheeks and said, "She's really good. She could pull this off." And he said, "I saw her. I'm sorry." What happened? "Somebody was setting off firecrackers in the woods," he said, and I closed my eyes tight, the ineluctable fact of the matter at hand. I had killed her. I went out after them, and I guess she drove off campus. It was late. She was on I-65 just south of downtown. A truck had jackknifed, blocking both lanes. A police car had just gotten to the scene. She hit the cruiser without ever swerving. I believe she must have been very intoxicated. The police said they smelled alcohol. "How do you know?" I asked. "I saw her, Miles. I talked to the police. It was instant." The steering wheel hit her chest. "I'm so sorry." And I said, "You saw her?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "How did she look?" And he said, "Just a bit of blood coming out of her nose." And I sat down on the floor of the gym. I could hear the colonel still screaming, and I could feel hands on my back as I hunched forward, but I could only see her lying naked on a metal table, a small trickle of blood falling out of her half-teardrop nose, her green eyes open, staring off into the distance, her mouth turned up just enough to suggest the idea of a smile. And she had felt so warm against me, her mouth soft and warm on mine. The colonel and I are walking back to our dorm room in silence. I am staring at the ground beneath me. I cannot stop thinking that she is dead, and I cannot stop thinking that she cannot possibly be dead. People do not just die. I can't catch my breath. I feel afraid, like someone has told me they're going to kick my ass after school and it's now sixth period and I know full well what's coming. It is so cold today, literally freezing, and I imagine running to the creek and diving in head first, the creek so shallow that my hands scrape against the rocks and my body slides into the cold water, the shock of the cold giving way to numbness, and I would stay there, float down with that water, first to the Cahaba River, then to the Alabama River, then to Mobile Bay and the Gulf of Mexico. I want to melt into the brown, crunchy grass that the Colonel and I step on as we silently make our way back to our room. His feet are so large, too large for his short body, and the new generic tennis shoes he wears since his old ones were pissed in look almost like clown shoes. I think of Alaska's flip-flops clinging to her blue toes as we swung on the swing down by the lake. Will the casket be open? Can a mortician recreate her smile? I could still hear her saying, "This is so fun, but I'm so sleepy." To be continued. 19th century preacher Henry Ward Beecher's last words were, "Now comes the mystery." The poet Dylan Thomas, who liked a good drink at least as much as Alaska, said, "I've had 18 straight whiskeys. I do believe that's a record," before dying. Alaska's favorite was playwright Eugene O'Neill. Born in a hotel room and, goddammit, died in a hotel room. Even car accident victims sometimes have time for last words. Princess Diana said, "Oh God, what's happened?" Movie star James Dean said, "They've got to see us," just before slamming his Porsche into another car. I know so many last words, but I will never know hers. I am several steps in front of him before I realize that the Colonel has fallen down. I turn around, and he is lying on his face. "We have to get up, Chip. We have to get up. We just have to get to the room." The Colonel turns his face from the ground to me and looks me dead in the eye and says, "I can't breathe." But he can breathe, and I know this because he is hyperventilating, breathing as if trying to blow air back into the dead. I pick him up, and he grabs onto me and starts sobbing, again saying, "I'm so sorry," over and over again. We have never hugged before, me and the Colonel, and there is nothing much to say, because he ought to be sorry. And I just put my hand on the back of his head and say the only true thing. I'm sorry, too. 2 days after. I didn't sleep that night. Dawn was slow in coming, and even when it did, the sun shining bright through the blinds, the rickety radiator couldn't keep us warm, so the Colonel and I sat wordlessly on the couch. He read the almanac. The night before, I'd braved the cold to call my parents, and this time when I said, "Hey, it's Miles," and my mom answered with, "What's wrong? Is everything okay?" I could safely tell her no, everything was not okay. My dad picked up the line then. "What's wrong?" he asked. "Don't yell," my mother said. "I'm not yelling, it's just the phone." "Well, talk quieter," she said, and so it took some time before I could say anything. And then once I could, it took some time to say the words in order. "My friend Alaska died in a car crash." I stared at the numbers and messages scrawled on the wall by the phone. "Oh, Miles," Mom said. "I'm so sorry, Miles. Do you want to come home?" "No," I said. "I want to be here." "I can't believe it," which was still partly true. "That's just awful," my dad said. "Her poor parents." Poor parent, I thought, and wondered about her dad. I couldn't even imagine what my parents would do if I died. Driving drunk. God, if her father ever found out, he would disembowel the Colonel and me. "What can we do for you right now?" my mom asked. "I just needed you to pick up. I just needed you to answer the phone, and you did." I heard a sniffle behind me, from cold or grief, I don't know, and told my parents, "Someone's waiting for the phone. I gotta go." All night, I felt paralyzed into silence, terrorized. What was I so afraid of, anyway? The thing had happened. She was dead. She was warm and soft against my skin, my tongue in her mouth, and she was laughing, trying to teach me, make me better, promising to be continued. And now... And now she was colder by the hour, more dead with every breath I took. I thought, that is the fear. I have lost something important, and I cannot find it, and I need it. It is fear like if someone lost his glasses and went to the glasses store, and they told him that the world had run out of glasses, and he would just have to do without. Just before 8 a.m, the colonel announced to no one in particular, "I think there are bufritos at lunch today." "Yeah," I said. "Are you hungry?"
"God, no." "But she named them, you know. They were called fried burritos when we got here, and Alaska started calling them bufritos, and then everyone did, and then finally Maureen officially changed the name."
He paused.
"I don't know what to do, Miles."
"Yeah, I know."
"I finished memorizing the capitals," he said.
"Of the states?"
"No, that was 5th grade. "Of the countries."
"Name a country."
"Canada," I said. "Something hard."
Uzbekistan?
"Tashkent."
He didn't even take a moment to think. It was just there at the tip of his tongue, as if he'd been waiting for me to say Uzbekistan all along. "Let's smoke." We walked to the bathroom and turned on the shower, and the colonel pulled a pack of matches from his jeans and struck a match against the matchbook. It didn't light. Again, he tried and failed, and again, smacking the matchbook with a crescendoing fury until he finally threw the matches to the ground and screamed, "God damn it!" "It's okay," I said, reaching into my pocket for a lighter.
"No, Pudge, it's not,"
he said, throwing down his cigarette and standing up, suddenly pissed. "God damn it! God, how did this happen? How could she be so stupid? She just never thought anything through, so goddamned impulsive. Christ, it is not okay! I can't believe she was so stupid."
"We should have stopped her," I said.
He reached into the stall to turn off the dribbling shower and then pounded an open palm against the tile wall.
"Yeah, I know we should have stopped her, damn it. I am shit sure keenly aware that we should have stopped her. But we shouldn't have had to. You had to watch her like a 3-year-old. You do one thing wrong, and then she just dies. Christ, I'm losing it. I'm going on a walk."
"Okay," I answered, trying to keep my voice calm.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I feel so screwed up. I feel like I might die."
"You might," I said.
"Yeah. Yeah, I might. You never know. It's just, it's like, poof, and you're gone."
I followed him into the room. He grabbed the almanac from his bunk, zipped his jacket, closed the door, and poof, he was gone. With morning came visitors. An hour after the colonel left, resident stoner Hank Walston dropped by to offer me some weed, which I graciously turned down. Hank hugged me and said,
"At least it was instant. At least there wasn't any pain."
I knew he was only trying to help, but he didn't get it. There was pain, a dull, endless pain in my gut that wouldn't go away even when I knelt on the stingingly frozen tile of the bathroom, dry heaving. And what is an instant death, anyway? How long is an instant? Is it 1 second? 10? The pain of those seconds must have been awful as her heart burst and her lungs collapsed, and there was no air and no blood to her brain and only raw panic. What the hell is instant? Nothing is instant. Instant rice takes 5 minutes. Instant pudding, an hour. I doubt that an instant of blinding pain feels particularly instantaneous. Was there time for her life to flash before her eyes? Was I there? Was Jake? And she promised, I remembered, she promised to be continued. But I knew, too, that she was driving north when she died. North toward Nashville. Toward Jake. Maybe it hadn't meant anything to her. Had been nothing more than another grand impulsivity. And as Hank stood in the doorway, I just looked past him, looking across the too quiet dorm circle, wondering if it had mattered to her. And I can only tell myself that, of course, yes. She had promised. To be continued. Lara came next, her eyes heavy with swelling. "What happened?" she asked me as I held her, standing on my tiptoes so I could place my chin on top of her head. I don't know, I said. Did you see her that night? She asked, speaking into my collarbone. She got drunk, I told her. The colonel and I went to sleep, and I guess she drove off campus. And that became the standard lie. I felt Lara's fingers, wet with her tears, press against my palm, and before I could think better of it, I pulled my hand away. I'm sorry, I said. It's okay, she said. I'll be in my room if you want to come by. I did not drop by. I didn't know what to say to her. I was caught in a love triangle with one dead side. That afternoon, we all filed into the gym again for a town meeting. The Eagle announced that the school would charter a bus on Sunday to the funeral in Vine Station. As we got up to leave, I noticed Takumi and Lara walking toward me. Lara caught my eye and smiled wanly. I smiled back, but quickly turned and hid myself amid the mass of mourners filing out of the gym. I am sleeping, and Alaska flies into the room. She is naked and intact. Her breasts, which I felt only very briefly and in the dark, are luminously full as they hang down from her body. She hovers inches above me, her breath warm and sweet against my face, like a breeze passing through tall grass. Hi, I say. I've missed you. You look good, Pudge. So do you. I'm so naked, she says, and laughs. How did I get so naked? I just want you to stay, I say. No, she says, and her weight falls dead on me, crushing my chest, stealing away my breath, and she is cold and wet like melting ice. Her head is split in half, and a pink-gray sludge oozes from the fracture in her skull and drips down onto my face, and she stinks of formaldehyde and rotting meat. I gag and push her off me, terrified. I woke up falling and landed with a thud on the floor. Thank God I'm a bottom bunk man. I had slept for 14 hours. It was morning. Wednesday, I thought. Her funeral Sunday. I wondered if the colonel would get back by then. Where he was. He had to come back for the funeral, because I could not go alone. And going with anyone other than the colonel would amount to alone. The cold wind buffeted against the door, and the trees outside the back window shook with such force that I could hear it from our room. And I sat in my bed and thought of the colonel out there somewhere, his head down, his teeth clenched, walking into the wind. 4 days after. It was 5 in the morning, and I was reading a biography of the explorer Meriwether Lewis of Anne Clark fame and trying to stay awake when the door opened and the colonel walked in. His pale hands shook, and the almanac he held looked like a puppet dancing without strings. "Are you cold?" I asked. He nodded, slipped off his sneakers, and climbed into my bed on the bottom bunk, pulling up the covers. His teeth chattered like Morse code. "Jesus, are you all right?" "Better now. Warmer," he said. A small ghost-white hand appeared from beneath the comforter. "Hold my hand, will you?" "All right, but that's it. No kissing." The quilt shook with his laughter. "Where have you been?" "I walked to Montevallo."
40 miles?
42, he corrected me. "Well, 42 there, 42 back. 82 miles. No, 84. Yes, 84 miles in 45 hours.
"What the hell's in Montevallo?" I asked.
"Not much. I just walked till I got too cold, and then I turned around."
"You didn't sleep?"
"No. The dreams are terrible. In my dreams, she doesn't even look like herself anymore. I don't even remember what she looked like."
I let go of his hand, grabbed last year's yearbook, and found her picture. In the black-and-white photograph, she's wearing her orange tank top and cut-off jeans that stretch halfway down her skinny thighs, her mouth open wide in a frozen laugh, as her left arm holds Takumi in a headlock. Her hair falls over her face, just enough to obscure her cheeks.
"Right," the colonel said. "Yeah, I was so tired of her getting upset for no reason. The way she would get sulky and make references to the freaking oppressive weight of tragedy or whatever.
but then never said what was wrong. Never have any goddamn reason to be sad. And I just think you ought to have a reason. My girlfriend dumped me, so I'm sad. I got caught smoking, so I'm pissed off. My head hurts, so I'm cranky. She never had a reason, Pudge. I was just so tired of putting up with her drama. And I just let her go. Christ. Her moodiness had annoyed me, too, sometimes, but not that night. That night I let her go because she told me to. It was that simple for me, and that stupid. The colonel's hand was so little, and I grabbed it tight, his cold seeping into me and my warmth into him.
I memorized the populations, he said.
Uzbekistan.
24,755,519.
Cameroon, I said, but it was too late. He was asleep, his hand limp in mine. I placed it back under the quilt and climbed up into his bed, a top bunk man for this night at least. I fell asleep listening to his slow, even breaths, his stubbornness finally melting away in the face of insurmountable fatigue. 6 days after. That Sunday, I got up after 3 hours of sleep and showered for the first time in a long while. I put on my only suit. I almost hadn't brought it, but my mom insisted that you never know when you're going to need a suit, and sure enough. The colonel did not own a suit, and by virtue of his stature could not borrow one from anyone at the creek, so he wore black slacks and a gray button-down.
I don't suppose I can wear the flamingo tie, he said as he pulled on black socks.
It's a bit festive, given the occasion, I responded.
Can't wear it to the opera, said the colonel, almost smiling. Can't wear it to a funeral. Can't use it to hang myself. It's a bit useless as ties go.
I gave him a tie. The school had chartered buses to ferry students north to Alaska's hometown of Vine Station, but Lara, the colonel, Takumi, and I drove in Takumi's SUV, taking the back roads so we didn't have to drive past the spot on the highway. I stared out the window, watching as the suburban sprawl surrounding Birmingham faded into the slow-sloping hills and fields of northern Alabama. Up front, Takumi told Lara about the time Alaska got her boob honked over the summer, and Lara laughed. That was the first time I had seen her, and now we were coming to the last. More than anything, I felt the unfairness of it, the inarguable injustice of loving someone who might have loved you back but can't due to deadness. And then I leaned forward, my forehead against the back of Takumi's headrest, and I cried, whimpering. And I didn't even feel sadness so much as pain. It hurt, and that is not a euphemism. It hurt like a beating. Meriwether Lewis's last words were, "I am not a coward, but I am so strong. So hard to die." I don't doubt that it is, but it cannot be much harder than being left behind. I thought of Lewis as I followed Lara into the A-frame chapel attached to the single-story funeral home in Vine Station, Alabama, a town every bit as depressed and depressing as Alaska had always made it out to be. The place smelled of mildew and disinfectant, and the yellow wallpaper in the foyer was peeling at the corners.
"Are y'all here for Ms. Young?"
a guy asked the colonel, and the colonel nodded. We were led to a large room with rows of folding chairs populated by only one man. He knelt before a coffin at the front of the chapel. The coffin was closed. Closed. Never going to see her again. Can't kiss her forehead. Can't see her one last time. But I needed to. I needed to see her. And much too loud, I asked, "Why is it closed?" And the man whose pot belly pushed out from his too tight suit turned around and walked toward me.
"Her mother," he said. "Her mother had an open casket, and Alaska told me, 'Don't ever let them see me dead, Daddy.' And so that's that. Anyway, son, she's not in there. She's with the Lord."
And he put his hands on my shoulders, this man who had grown fat since he'd last had to wear a suit, and I couldn't believe what I had done to him, his eyes glittering green like Alaska's, but sunk deep into dark sockets, like a green-eyed, still-breathing ghost. "And don't
No, don't die, Alaska. Don't die. And I walked out of his embrace and passed Laura and Takumi to her casket, and knelt before it, and placed my hands on the finished wood, the dark mahogany, the color of her hair. I felt the colonel's small hands on my shoulders, and a tear dripped onto my head. And for a few moments, it was just the three of us. The buses of students hadn't arrived, and Takumi and Laura had faded away, and it was just the three of us. Three bodies and two people. The three who knew what had happened, and too many layers between all of us. Too much keeping us from one another. The colonel said, "I just want to save her so bad." And I said, "Chip, she's gone." And he said, "I thought I'd feel her looking down on us, but you're right. She's just gone." And I said, "Oh, God, Alaska, I love you. I love you." And the colonel whispered, "I'm so sorry, Pudge. I know you did." And I said, "No, not past tense. She wasn't even a person anymore, just flesh, rotting. But I loved her, present tense." The colonel knelt down beside me and put his lips to the coffin and whispered, "I am sorry, Alaska. You deserved a better friend." Is it so hard to die, Mr. Lewis? Is that labyrinth really worse than this one? 7 days after. I spent the next day in our room, playing football on mute, at once unable to do nothing and unable to do anything much. It was Martin Luther King Day, our last day before classes started again, and I could think of nothing but having killed her. The colonel spent the morning with me, but then decided to go to the cafeteria for meatloaf.
"Let's go," he said.
"Not hungry."
"You have to eat."
"Want to bet?" I said, without looking up from the game.
"Christ, fine."
He sighed and left, slamming the door behind him. He's still very angry, I found myself thinking with a bit of pity. No reason to be angry. Anger just distracts from the all-encompassing sadness, the frank knowledge that you killed her and robbed her of a future and a life. Getting pissed wouldn't fix it. Damn it. "How's the meatloaf?" I asked the colonel when he returned.
"About as you remember it. Neither meaty nor loafy."
The colonel sat down next to me.
"The eagle ate with me. He wanted to know if we set off the fireworks."
I paused the game and turned to him. With one hand, he picked at one of the last remaining pieces of blue vinyl on our foam couch. "And you said?" I asked.
"I didn't, rat. Anyway, he said her aunt or something is coming tomorrow to clean out her room. So if there's anything that's ours, or anything her aunt wouldn't want to find..."
I turned back to the game and said, "I'm not up for it today."
"Then I'll do it alone," he answered.
He turned and walked outside, leaving the door open, and the bitter remnants of the cold snap quickly overwhelmed the radiator. So I paused the game and stood up to close the door, and when I peeked around the corner to see if the colonel had entered her room, he was standing there, just outside our door, and he grabbed onto my sweatshirt, smiled, and said,
"I knew you wouldn't make me do that alone. I knew it."
I shook my head and rolled my eyes, but followed him down the sidewalk, past the payphone, and into her room. I hadn't thought of her smell since she died, but when the colonel opened the door, I caught the edge of her scent, wet dirt and grass and cigarette smoke, and beneath that, the vestiges of vanilla-scented skin lotion. She flooded into my present, and only tact kept me from burying my face in the dirty laundry overfilling the hamper by her dresser. It looked as I remembered it, hundreds of books stacked against the walls, her lavender comforter crumpled at the foot of her bed, a precarious stack of books on her bedside table, her volcanic candle just peeking out from beneath the bed. It looked as I knew it would, but the smell, unmistakably her, shocked me. I stood in the center of the room, my eyes shut, inhaling slowly through my nose, the vanilla and the uncut autumn grass. But with each slow breath, the smell faded as I became accustomed to it, and soon she was gone again. "This is unbearable," I said matter-of-factly, because it was. "God, these books she'll never read, her life's library."
"Bought at garage sales and now probably destined for another one."
Ashes to ashes, garage sale to garage sale, I said.
Right, okay, down to business. Get anything her aunt wouldn't want to find, the colonel said,
and I saw him kneeling at her desk, the drawer beneath her computer pulled open, his small fingers pulling out groups of stapled papers.
Christ, she kept every paper she ever wrote. Moby Dick, Ethan Frome.
I reached between her mattress and box spring for the condoms I knew she hid for Jake's visits. I pocketed them, and then went over to her dresser, searching through her underwear for hidden bottles of liquor or sex toys or God knows what. I found nothing. And then I settled on the books, staring at them stacked on their sides, spines out, the haphazard collection of literature that was Alaska. There was one book I wanted to take with me, but I couldn't find it. The colonel was sitting on the floor next to her bed, his head bent toward the floor, looking under her bed frame.
"She sure didn't leave any booze, did she?" he asked.
And I almost said she buried it in the woods out by the soccer field, but I realized that the colonel didn't know, that she never took him to the edge of the woods and told him to dig for buried treasure, that she and I had shared that alone, and I kept it for myself like a keepsake, as if sharing the memory might lead to its dissipation. "Do you see the general in his labyrinth anywhere?" I asked while scanning the titles on the book spines. "It has a lot of green on the cover, I think. It's a paperback, and it got flooded, so the pages are probably bloated, but I don't think she—" And then he cut me off with,
"Yeah, it's right here."
And I turned around, and he was holding it, the pages fanned out like an accordion, from Longwell Jeff and Kevin's prank, and I walked over to him and took it and sat down on her bed. The places she'd underlined and the little notes she'd written had all been blurred out by the soaking, but the book was still mostly readable, and I was thinking I would take it back to my room and try to read it, even though it wasn't a biography, when I flipped to that page, toward the back. He was shaken by the overwhelming revelation that the headlong race between his misfortunes and his dreams was at that moment reaching the finish line. The rest was darkness. "Damn it," he sighed. "How will I ever get out of this labyrinth?" The whole passage was underlined in bleeding, water-soaked black ink, but there was another ink, this one a crisp blue post-flood, and an arrow led from "How will I ever get out of this labyrinth?" to a margin note written in her loop-heavy cursive, "Straight and fast." "Hey, she wrote something in here after the flood," I said, "but it's weird. Look, page 192. I tossed the book to the colonel, and he flipped to the page, and then looked up at me.
"Straight and fast," he said.
"Yeah. Weird, huh? The way out of the labyrinth, I guess."
"Wait, how did it happen? What happened?"
And because there was only one "it," I knew to what he was referring. "I told you what the eagle told me. A truck jackknifed on the road. A cop car showed up to stop traffic, and she ran into the cop car. She was so drunk she didn't even swerve."
"So drunk?
So drunk? The cop car would have had its lights on." "Pudge, she ran into a cop car that had its lights on," he said hurriedly. "Straight and fast.
Straight and fast out of the labyrinth."
"No," I said, but even as I said it, I could see it. I could see her drunk enough and pissed off enough. About what? About cheating on Jake? About hurting me? About wanting me and not him? Still pissed about ratting out Mariah? I could see her staring down the cop car and aiming for it, not giving a shit about anyone else, not thinking of her promise to me, not thinking of her father or anyone, and that bitch, she killed herself. But no, no, that was not her. No, she said to be continued. Of course.
No. Yeah, you're probably right, the colonel said.
He dropped the book, sat down on the bed next to me, and put his forehead in his hands.
Who drives 6 miles off campus to kill herself? Doesn't make any sense. But straight and fast? Bit of an odd premonition, isn't it? And we still don't really know what happened, if you think about it. Where she was going, why, who called? Someone called, right? Or did I make...
And the colonel kept talking, puzzling it out while I picked up the book and found my way to that page where the general's headlong race came to its end, and we were both stuck in our heads,
the distance between us unbridgeable, and I could not listen to the colonel because I was busy trying to get the last hints of her smell, busy telling myself that of course she hadn't done it. It was me. I had done it. And so had the colonel. He could try to puzzle his way out of it, but I knew better, knew that we could never be anything but wholly, unforgivably guilty. 8 days after. Tuesday, we had school for the first time. Madame O'Malley had a moment of silence at the beginning of French class, a class that was always punctuated with long moments of silence, and then asked us how we were feeling. "Awful," a girl said. "En français," Madame O'Malley replied. "En français." Everything looked the same, but more still. The weekday warriors still sat on the benches outside the library, but their gossip was quiet, understated. The cafeteria clamored with the sounds of plastic trays against wooden tables and forks scraping plates, but any conversations were muted. But more than the noiselessness of everyone else was the silence where she should have been, the bubbling, bursting, storytelling Alaska. But instead, it felt like those times when she had withdrawn into herself, like she was refusing to answer how or why questions, only this time for good. The colonel sat down next to me in religion class, sighed, and said,
"You reek of smoke, Pudge."
"Ask me if I give a shit." Dr. Hyde shuffled into class then, our final exams stacked underneath one arm. He sat down, took a series of labored breaths, and began to talk.
"It is a law that parents should not have to bury their children," he said, "and someone should enforce it. This semester, we're going to continue studying the religious traditions to which you were introduced this fall. But there's no doubting that the questions we'll be asking have more immediacy now than they did just a few days ago. What happens to us after we die, for instance, is no longer a question of idle philosophical interest. It is a question we must ask about our classmate. And how to live in the shadow of grief is not something nameless Buddhists, Christians, and Muslims have to explore. The questions of religious thought have become, I suspect, personal."
He shuffled through our exams, pulling one out from the pile before him.
"I have here Alaska's final. You'll recall that you were asked what the most important question facing people is, and how the three traditions we're studying this year address that question. This was Alaska's question."
With a sigh, he grabbed hold of his chair and lifted himself out of it, then wrote on the blackboard, "How will we ever get out of this labyrinth of suffering? A.Y."
"I'm going to leave that up for the rest of the semester," he said, "because everybody who has ever lost their way in life has felt the nagging insistence of that question. At some point, we all look up and realize we are lost in a maze, and I don't want us to forget Alaska. And I don't want to forget that even when the material we study seems boring, we're trying to understand how people have answered that question, and the questions each of you posed in your papers. How different traditions have come to terms with what Chip, in his final, called people's rotten lots in life."
Hyde sat down.
"So, how are you guys doing?"
The colonel and I said nothing, while a bunch of people who didn't know Alaska extolled her virtues and professed to be devastated, and at first it bothered me. I didn't want the people she didn't know and the people she didn't like to be sad. They'd never cared about her, and now they were carrying on as if she were a sister. But I guess I didn't know her completely either. If I had, I'd have known what she meant by "to be continued." And if I had cared about her as I should have, as I thought I did, how could I have let her go? So they didn't bother me, really. But next to me, the colonel breathed slowly and deeply through his nose like a bull about to charge.
He actually rolled his eyes when weekday warrior Brooke Blakely, whose parents had received a progress report courtesy of Alaska, said,